Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. In this lecture, I'll introduce you to game theory, which, despite its name, is not actually a theory so much as a tool for developing theories, or theoretical models at any rate. You'll see a lot of game theoretic models in future lectures, and I hope you'll agree that they help us to better understand key aspects of international relations. But before we can put the tool to work addressing the big puzzles I laid out in the first lecture, we've got to have some sense of how it works. As I say on the first slide, there are three things I'm going to do in this lecture. First, I'll introduce some more terms and concepts. Second, I'll show you how to identify equilibria in the simplest sorts of game theoretic models. Finally, I'll take you through an example of a more sophisticated model. The simplest models are very, very easy to analyze. Easy enough that I'll expect you to do so yourselves at times. But they're also quite limited. For that reason, you at least need to know how to interpret the results of more advanced models and have some sense of how I've gone about analyzing them, because I'll rely on them quite a bit in future lectures. Okay, turn to the second slide. The first term I need to define for you is utility. That's because the one assumption all game theoretic models make is that people maximize expected utility. Beyond that, incidentally, game theoretic models can vary quite a bit. I'll talk more in the next lecture about what different theories of international relations assume about who the relevant actors are and what it is they want. But we're always going to be assuming they want something and that they act in ways that are likely to help them get it. What we'll assume will change from model to model, though, because there's no right set of assumptions. As I discussed in the second lecture, we always need to simplify, and depending on what we're trying to achieve, some forms of simplification may be more appropriate than others. As it says on the slide, utility is a subjective measure of how much value an actor attaches to an outcome or expects to receive from pursuing a particular strategy. Sometimes we'll refer to that as their payoff. Same thing, just different wording. When you see utilities written out formally, you'll see a lowercase u for utility, a subscript identifying the actor who receives that utility, then, in parentheses, either an outcome or a strategy. Expected utilities, by the way, would be written with a capital E in front of a set of parentheses containing the U and everything else, and that simply reflects the expected value, see the lecture on probability if you don't know what an expected value is, of the actor's utility. That is, expected utilities take into account all the different outcomes that might occur as a result of pursuing a particular strategy. I'll explain that more later on in the lecture and give you some examples. A strategy, by the way, is formally defined as a detailed plan that specifies what actions an actor will take at all junctures, regardless of whether they are actually reached in equilibrium. That's an important distinction. If I show you a game theoretic model where some actor may potentially be called upon to make two or three different decisions based on how the other player reacts, and you determine that in practice they'll only ever have to make one decision because the game will end before the others would come up, the proper way to state their equilibrium strategy will still tell me what they would have done at those later stages had the game continued. And I might try to trick you with that very soon, so don't fall for it. There are two basic types of games, normal form and extensive form. You'll see both in this module. In normal form games, the actors must make their decisions simultaneously. These are usually represented with matrices, which look like tables. In extensive form games, the actors make decisions sequentially, one after the other. These are often represented by decision trees. You'll see examples of both later this lecture. Regardless of which type of game the actors are playing, What we as analysts are interested in is identifying the equilibrium, or equilibria, if there's more than one. An equilibrium, as you can see on the fourth slide, is a set of strategies and, where relevant, beliefs that leaves no player with an incentive to unilaterally deviate, and thus identifies outcomes which are stable. Beliefs are estimates of how likely different things are to happen. They're relevant when one or more actors faces uncertainty. I'll close out this lecture with an example of that. An incentive to unilaterally deviate exists when an actor can receive more utility by changing their strategy, holding constant the strategy of the other player. That is, if it's possible for one or more actors to do better in principle, but only if two or more actors agree to change their strategy simultaneously, that does not mean that anyone has an incentive to unilaterally deviate. That's an important distinction, because no one can control anyone's behavior but their own. They can try to influence that of others through a mix of carrots and sticks or simple persuasion, but when we seek to identify equilibria, what we want to ask is whether we've identified a combination of strategies whereby no one can make themselves better off by changing their individual behavior. Because if they can, they obviously would. But if they can't, they may not be happy about where they're going to end up, but there's a good chance that it is indeed where they're going to end up. At least if there's only one equilibrium and if the model maps onto reality fairly well. Backwards induction, as it says on the slide, is a technique for identifying equilibria in extensive form games, whereby decisions are analyzed in reverse order and players are assumed to be forward-looking. That may sound a bit abstract at the moment, but I'll show you an example very soon, and I think you'll be surprised at how straightforward it is. Finally, before we get to the examples, there are two reasons an actor might face uncertainty. One is that they lack information about the other player's preferences. That's true in games of incomplete information. The other is that they weren't able to observe some previous decision that was already made. That's true in games of imperfect information. I know, those names are less than ideal. Incomplete and imperfect, in ordinary language, are pretty close to synonymous. But that's the convention people smarter than you and me came up with, so we just have to go with it. So, turn to the sixth slide, where you'll find an example of a normal form game. This one is pretty famous, as such things go. It's known as the Stag Hunt, and it's based on the work of philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. This is a nice, simple game, so there's just one choice made by each player. They have to decide whether to hunt a stag, that's a fancy word for a grown male deer, or a hare, which belongs to the same family as rabbits. If they work together to bring down a stag, we assume they'll be successful, and they'll both eat well that night. But they need to work together to do it. If either goes after a stag on their own, they're going to go hungry. Hares, apparently, are easier to take down. I'd have thought it'd be hard to hit such a small, fast-moving target, but what do I know? We therefore assume that anyone who decides to hunt a hare will have something to eat that night, though not as much as if the two hunters were to split a stag. That's three possible outcomes each: go hungry, eat a hare, or share a stag. And we assign utilities of 0, 1, and 2, respectively, to those outcomes, just for the sake of simplicity. All that really matters here is that larger numbers are better. We could say that going hungry brings a payoff of negative 1, or positive 13.7, and it wouldn't really matter, as long as we gave the players more utility for catching a hare, and even more utility for sharing a stag. We could also use variable payoffs, allowing for the fact that not everyone likes venison, and some people don't even eat meat of any kind, but we're going to keep things simple for now. I'm just trying to show you how we analyze normal form games, because you'll see a lot of them in the first half of this module. So how do we read these matrices? Well, in each cell, we have two numbers. The first tells us the utility received by the row player, typically referred to as player 1. The second, the column player, player 2. So if both players choose a strategy of stag, the game will end in the upper left cell, and each will receive a 2. Because if they choose that strategy, we'll assume they succeed in bringing down a stag, and they'll both have a lot of meat. If player 1 chooses stag, while player 2 chooses hare, they end up in the upper right cell, and player 1 receives a payoff of 0, because they're going to go hungry, while player 2 gets a 1. Similarly, if player 1 chooses hare and 2 stag, they end up in the lower left, where 1 gets a 1 and 2 a 0. Finally, if they both choose hare, they end up in the lower right cell, and each receives a utility of 1. How do we identify equilibria? Recall that, by definition, equilibria are sets of strategies that leave no player with an incentive to unilaterally deviate. So let's just go through each combination in no particular order and see if either player would be better off switching to a different strategy. How about hare-stag, meaning player 1 hunts a hare and 2 hunts a stag? Would that comprise an equilibrium? No, it would not. If player 2 hunts a stag, player 1 is better off doing so as well. And if player 1 hunts a hare, player 2 is also better off doing the same thing. So they'd both have an incentive to deviate from the strategies in question. Does it matter if they both do, as opposed to just one? No. If even one player has no interest in pursuing the strategy that defines the equilibrium, then we can't actually be talking about an equilibrium. But this particular combination of strategies is doubly unstable, in a sense. Since everything is symmetric, obviously stag-hare can't be in equilibrium either. What about hare-hare? That wouldn't be the best possible outcome. It would mean both players have less to eat than they could have, and therefore less utility. An economist would call that outcome Pareto inferior to stag-stag. Pareto inferior outcomes, incidentally, bring less utility to at least one player, without bringing greater utility to anyone, than is true of at least one other outcome. Pareto superior outcomes bring more utility to at least one player, without bringing less to anyone, than all other outcomes. But that's not what I'm asking at the moment. I want to know if it's an equilibrium, which simply means that if, for whatever reason, we arrived at that outcome, that combination of strategies, we'd stay there because no one could do better by changing their individual behavior. And sadly, the answer is yes. If player 1 and player 2 are both hunting hares, neither one is going to unilaterally change their mind and go after a stag. Because if they do, they're going to go hungry. So the model is telling us that bad outcomes can occur as a result of each player doing what's in their best interest. We can't just tell them that they're being stupid and expect things to change, which, sadly, is what journalists and so many others tend to do when these situations arise in politics. The problem is, neither player is being stupid on their own. They've both chosen the best possible course of action, considering what the other is doing. That's tragic, but it's certainly not stupid. I use this example, of course, because I'm going to try to convince you in future lectures that there are real-world examples of this. That part of the reason there isn't more cooperation in the world, sadly, is that sometimes states do what's in their best interest individually, but collectively, that means that everyone's worse off. They might very well be aware of this, but if the only way to reap the benefits of cooperation is to get everyone to change their behavior at the same time, well, that might not be so easy to do. Especially since international relations is often more analogous to a 200-player game than a 2-player game. So, I've actually given you one answer to one of our big puzzles already, though I haven't gone into as much detail about that explanation as I will later on. Note, by the way, that stag-stag is also an equilibrium. It's just not the only one, as we might perhaps like it to be. If, for whatever reason, both players agreed to go after the stag, no one would have any incentive to deviate from that agreement. Of course, in real life, states sometimes do have incentives to go back on their word, but the point of this model is that even if they didn't, cooperation still wouldn't be assured. Sometimes, states get stuck in a bad equilibrium, and finding their way to a better one isn't always easy. If they could get there, though, they'd stay there. I'll talk more in future lectures about examples of that, because I think that really has happened, and I also think those problems have, at times, been solved. Again, the point of this lecture isn't to address our big puzzles just yet. It's to teach you basic game theory, so that you'll be able to follow along when I'm ready to do that. I hope, then, that you feel comfortable checking for equilibria in simple, normal form games, because you'll be asked to do that on the first test. If not, you should go back and listen to this section again, or email me, or talk to me after the next in-class activity. Okay, let's move on to extensive form games. On the next slide, you see a sort of frivolous example of one concerning teenage angst. We'll analyze very serious extensive form games later, meant to model international crises that could escalate to war, but I thought I'd go with this for now. We've all been there before. This version makes very strong assumptions. There's only going to be one equilibrium, which would suggest that interactions of this sort always end the same way, which of course they don't. For that reason, I'll show you a more realistic version right after I've explained how to analyze models with uncertainty. But first, let's talk through the super simple, extremely unrealistic version. We've got two players in this game, the same as the last one, but they make their decisions sequentially. That is, at the start of the game, Smitten decides whether to admire Crush from afar, safe from the possibility of rejection, or to go for it. If and only if Smitten decides to go for it, Crush then decides whether to shoot them down or give them a chance. So this isn't like the stag hunt, where both players had to make a decision no matter what, and had to do so without knowing what the other one was going to do. Crush only has to make a decision if Smitten approaches them. That much, I'd argue, is pretty realistic. That's not always how these things go down, but the part we're going to need to relax later on isn't so much the basic structure of the game as it is the assumptions I've made about the payoffs. At the moment, they're very rigid. I've only done that because it's easier to explain backwards induction and the identification of equilibria in extensive form games when everything is straightforward. But the real world is messy, and so it's often helpful for our models to be at least a little bit messy as well. We'll get there soon. As with normal form games, extensive form games display utilities in pairs. At each terminal node, we're given the payoff for the first player to make a decision in the game, in this case, Smitten, followed by the payoff for the next player to make a decision, in this case, Crush, and so on if there's more than two. The payoffs are separated by commas. I've given both players a payoff of zero if Smitten decides to play it safe and admire Crush in secret. No one will be made better off, but neither will anyone get hurt. If Smitten goes for it and Crush shoots them down, they both lose utility. For the sake of simplicity, at the moment, I'm assigning each of them a negative one. Obviously, that's something you could quibble with. And in fact, that's one of the assumptions I'm going to relax in the second version of the model. But for now, they both get a negative one, mostly because that keeps things really, really simple. And again, for the sake of simplicity more than anything else, I've assigned both players a one in the event that Smitten goes for it and Crush gives them a chance. That's more than a little optimistic, of course, at least from Smitten's perspective, and so we'll back away from that very strong assumption soon. But now we've got everything we need to solve this game, and you can finally see how backwards induction works. We can worry about relaxing our assumptions, allowing for more than one possible way for the game to end, later, after we've talked about how to incorporate uncertainty. To apply backwards induction, we start at one of the terminal nodes and ask what the player who makes a decision there would do. Which of their two or more choices brings them more utility? If you don't like the implicit assumption that people are selfish, you can rewrite the player's utilities to be interdependent, say, by penalizing one player for lowering the other's utility, as I've actually already done by giving Crush a -1 when they shoot Smitten down. But we still solve models by identifying strategies that maximize players' individual expected utilities. In this case, there's only one terminal node, and that's the one where Crush decides whether to shoot Smitten down or give them a chance. And in this super simplistic version, shooting Smitten down brings Crush a payoff of -1, while giving Smitten a chance yields a payoff of 1. Since 1 is bigger than -1, Crush's optimal strategy is to give Smitten a chance. For now, Smitten can anticipate that. So Smitten only has to compare the 0 they get if they decide to secretly admire Crush to the 1 they get for sure in this version of the model if they go for it. Obviously, then, they go for it, because 1 is bigger than 0. That means the unique equilibrium to this game is go for it, give them a chance. And that's it. We're done with this version of the model. Easy enough, right? If you were to see an extensive form game on the first test, you'd know how to figure out what the equilibrium is or equilibria are, right? I hope so, because there's a 100% chance of that happening. If not, you know what to do. Okay. Let's take a little detour to talk about decision-making in the face of uncertainty before we revisit our model of teenage angst. Suppose an actor faces a choice between A and B, where A is a sure thing, but B entails some risk. Specifically, as I say on the 8th slide, assume that A always brings X utility, whereas B either brings a payoff of Z times X or 0, and the former happens with probability 1 over Z, and thus the latter with probability 1 minus 1 over Z. I haven't said it on the slide, but assume that X is positive and Z is not just positive, but greater than 1. That means that choosing B brings some chance of an outcome that's strictly better than X, but also some chance of getting nothing at all. If Z were 2, for example, there'd be a 50% chance of getting something twice as good as X, and a 50% chance of getting nothing. If Z was 3, there'd be a 1/3 chance of getting something 3 times as good as X, and a 2/3 chance of getting nothing. If you listen to the lecture on probability, you'll note that the expected value of B is precisely X. This setup helps me explain the formal definitions of different attitudes towards risk. A person who is risk acceptant would strictly prefer option B to option A here. Such a person would also be willing to take bad bets in the sense that they choose the risky option even when the expected value thereof is less than that of the sure thing. How much less? Well, that depends on how risk acceptant they are. A risk averse person would strictly prefer A to B. Such individuals are unwilling to take good bets in the sense that they would choose the sure thing even when the expected value thereof is less than that of the risky option. How much less? Again, that depends on exactly how risk-averse they are. A risk-neutral person is truly indifferent between A and B. They take good bets and do not take bad bets. These terms have precise technical definitions, but they're sometimes used by journalists who probably learned about them at some point but don't remember the proper definitions. For that reason, you'll often hear on the news that the stock market is down because investors have become more risk-averse. That's ridiculous. If the expected value of an investment suddenly declines, a risk-neutral person will be less likely to invest in it. You can only infer risk aversion from a decreased rate of investment if you know that would-be investors are actually turning down good bets. If all that's changed is the expected return, there's no need to talk about a change in underlying fundamental attitudes towards risk, which don't change very often. Yet for some reason, when invoking risk aversion, journalists never even try to convince us that they know for a fact that the investments that aren't being made are good ones. That irritates me. Anyway, we're going to assume that everyone is risk neutral in this module. Why? Not because I have any particular reason to believe that's the case. I don't. But for what I hope are obvious reasons, after that rant about journalists and the stock market, sorting that out isn't always easy. A lot of people simply assume that anyone who takes risks must be risk-acceptant, and anyone who doesn't must be risk-averse, but without knowing whether the risks they did or didn't take had the same expected value as some safer option, we really can't draw such conclusions. You might think Putin is risk-acceptant, or that Obama is risk-averse, but unless you've got fairly precise estimates of the expected values of their decisions, as well as those of the options they didn't take, you're abusing terminology at best and spouting tautologies at worst. The other reason I'm always going to assume risk neutrality is that it keeps our models simple without really affecting their usefulness. The substantive conclusions we'd reach about patterns of cooperation and conflict would be the same, even if we allowed for the possibility of risk acceptance or risk aversion. We'd just need uglier maths to get to them, and no one wants that, not even me. When actors face uncertainty, it's not enough to compare the payoff they know for sure they will get if they choose one thing to the payoff they know for sure they will get if they choose another. For at least one of their choices, we must calculate an expected utility instead. Expected utilities do not tell us what will actually happen if the actor makes a certain choice, but instead give us a quantity that summarizes how good or bad the choice is. Think back to the lecture on probability, where I told you that the expected value of a coin flip was 5 quid, even though there was precisely zero chance you'd end up with 5 quid. The same principle applies here. For risk-neutral actors, expected utilities are simply expected values, where the values are measured in terms of utility. So if some course of action entails a 50% chance of reaching an outcome that brings a utility of 1, and a 50% chance of reaching an outcome that brings a utility of negative 1, the expected utility of that course of action is 0, even though you will never actually get 0. That's pretty much all the formal notation on this slide says. If you're confused, I suggest you go back and listen to the lecture on probability. The next slide has some numerical examples. I won't go through them, though. Some of you may find this slide helpful, but I bet others already understand the concept of expected utility quite well. It is pretty straightforward, after all, once you grasp expected values, which, again, I discussed in the lecture on probability. But I do suggest you pause the lecture now and look at that table for a few moments. If you understand how I arrived at those expected utilities for choice B, and why I've written that a risk-neutral actor would choose A in 3 instances, but B in the others, you're in good shape. If not, you've got some catching up to do. Ready to move on? Okay, turn to slide 10. Here, you see the model of teen angst again, but we're going to spice things up a bit this time around. I've changed two of the payoffs, and we're introducing uncertainty over one of them. First, I no longer assign Smitten a payoff of -1 in the event that they get shot down by Crush. Instead, they suffer a loss of utility reflective of the sensitivity of their ego. That is, their utility at that outcome is negative E, and E can take on any positive value. The larger it is, the more hurt they'll be if Crush shoots them down. If E is very small, though, then Smitten doesn't have a very fragile ego, and while they'd still prefer to be given a chance, or even to go back in time and choose to simply admire Crush from afar, they'll get over it pretty quickly. Second, I've changed Crush's payoff for giving Smitten a chance to I, short for interest. This can take on positive or negative values. More on that in just a minute. As I said, we're not just changing the utilities, but introducing uncertainty as well. Specifically, we'll now assume that Smitten does not know the precise value of I, meaning they don't know how interested Crush is in them. We're going to allow Smitten to make a guess, though, because otherwise there's not a whole lot more that we can say. And because, while many people are pretty bad at this sort of thing in real life, including many who think they're good at it, most of us have some beliefs about how likely different scenarios are, even if they're crude and inaccurate. And we don't need Smitten's beliefs about how likely it is that Crush has some interest in them to be accurate. We just need them to exist. That's a pretty low bar. To avoid the need for calculus, which would probably make you riot, I'm going to assume that Smitten only entertains two possibilities. One is that Crush is the red type, in which case they have a relatively low level of interest in Smitten. So low that they wouldn't even go on a pity date, as they would if we didn't restrict I underline to be less than -1. And the other is that Crush is the blue type, in which case their interest is higher, high enough, in fact, that they will not only give Smitten a chance, but be happy that Smitten went for it. Smitten also knows how likely it is that they are dealing with each type, or at least has some belief about that, which we're going to assume is accurate for the sake of simplicity, though we could relax that if we really wanted to. Specifically, Smitten believes, correctly, that Crush is the blue type with probability phi, and the red type with probability 1 minus phi. A quick note about colors here. You've probably noticed I sometimes use dark green. That's just for emphasis, the same as boldface font. Red and blue are different. Every time I walk you through a model with incomplete information, there will be two types of one of the players. That means that while there are only two players playing the game, one of them has to keep track of two possible versions of the other, because they don't know for sure who they are dealing with. More sophisticated models allow for a whole range of possibilities, but as I said, that requires calculus, and I'm not going to go there. Besides, assuming that there are only two possibilities doesn't really affect the results anyway. We'd word things a bit differently if we took a more flexible approach, but the real substantive implications wouldn't much differ. Not only will there always be two types, but I'll help you keep track of the difference using color coding. What differentiates the types won't always be exactly the same. Here, it's one actor's level of romantic interest in another. In some models, it will be how tempted one state is to try exploiting other states. In other models, it will be how good one state's military is at the conduct of war. But the blue type will always be the type that the uninformed player would rather be dealing with. More romantically interested, less tempted to exploit, less martially effective. The red type will be the one you hope you're not facing. Got all that? Okay, good. Turn to the last slide. Smitten now compares U, S, admire, Smitten's utility for secretly admiring Crush, to E, U.S. go for it, or Smitten's expected utility for going for it. Why does the left-hand side have just a plain old U, while the right-hand side has the uppercase E in front of it? If you know what I'm about to say, you're doing great. You're really on top of things. If not, that's a sign that you're not really on top of things. Perhaps you're listening to all the lectures, and that's great, but you're apparently not paying close enough attention when you do so. Or you're not asking questions when you find things confusing, which you really should. Granted, I'm not going to ask this particular question on the test, but if you don't know the answer to it, that probably means that there are other things you're not on top of that you should be. I'd encourage you to sort that out as soon as possible before we get too deep into the module. The answer to that question, by the way, is that Smitten knows exactly what utility they'll receive if they admire Crush from afar. There's no uncertainty there. No need to bring expectations into it. But they don't know for sure what will happen if they go for it, because they don't know if they're dealing with the red type who will shoot them down, or the blue type who will give them a chance. So, we're looking for the conditions under which Smitten will admire Crush from afar. The inequalities you see below this first line are mathematically equivalent to U.S. admire being greater than or equal to E.U.S. go for it. They're telling us when something very specific would be true, not asserting that anything is true. And that will be true when 0 is greater than or equal to the expression on the right-hand side, which is phi times 1, because the probability that Crush is the blue type is phi, and when they are, they give Smitten a chance, which will bring Smitten a payoff of 1, plus 1 minus phi times negative e, because the probability that Crush is the red type is 1 minus phi, and when they are, they'll shoot Smitten down, which brings Smitten a payoff of negative e. In other words, we're comparing the sure thing payoff of 0 to the expected utility of going for it, taking into account the fact that going for it can either bring an outcome that's better than 0, but can also bring one that's worse, just like in the example I used at the end of the algebra refresher. Through some simple algebraic manipulation, which I won't walk you through now, but I'd be happy to explain in class or by email, we can show that Smitten is better off admiring Crush from afar when phi is less than or equal to phi hat, where phi hat is just shorthand for e over 1 plus e. What does that mean? Well, it's not as complicated as it sounds. That means that, all else equal, Smitten is less likely to play it safe, the more likely they think it is that Crush has an interest in them. Where did I get that from? Well, remember, phi is the probability that Crush is the blue type, and the blue type has a strictly positive level of interest in Smitten. And I just determined that Smitten plays it safe when phi is less than some threshold. So the lower phi is, the more likely Smitten is to play it safe. Conversely, the higher phi is, the more confident they are that Crush is interested in them, the more likely they are to go for it. And that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? The other thing the model tells us, which I think also makes sense, is that the threshold that determines whether Smitten plays it safe moves closer to 0 as E moves closer to 0. Don't believe me? Plug some numbers into that fraction. What does that mean? Remember, Smitten plays it safe if and only if phi is less than or equal to phi hat. If phi hat is arbitrarily close to 0, very few values of phi will lie below it. It's almost guaranteed, then, that Smitten won't play it safe. In other words, when E is small, meaning Smitten's ego isn't very sensitive, then Smitten is probably going to go for it, even if they think it's quite likely that Crush will shoot them down. Because they don't really care if they get shot down. They'd prefer not to be, everyone would, but the prospect for them isn't very scary. On the other hand, if E is enormous, if Smitten has a very delicate ego and is crippled by the fear of rejection, then Phi needs to be very, very close to 1 before Smitten will risk it, because most values of Phi will lie below Phi hat. Meaning that they have to be really confident that Crush likes them before they'll go for it. Pretty intuitive, yeah? As long as you pay attention when I tell you what the symbols mean, and take the time to translate symbolic statements like the one at the bottom of this slide back into English, I think you'll find that this game theory stuff isn't so bad, especially since I've done all the hard work for you. The results I come up with should make a lot of sense to you after the fact. Sometimes they point in directions we might not have thought to look. That's one of the reasons I consider these models valuable. But most of the time, they just sharpen our intuitions by adding qualifiers to things we might have thought were true across the board. Which is also valuable, of course, but isn't going to make any heads explode. What I'm saying is that, intimidating as the notation can be, you should think to yourself, okay, yeah, that makes sense, more often than not when I take you through the results of the models. Otherwise, one of us is doing something wrong. And not to be rude, but that someone's probably you.